Hey, Seven.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time. Interested in seeing what you guys are doing at Orchid, and you have a really interesting background as well, which I'm excited to talk about. First, I think it makes sense to get started. You have a pretty interesting nickname, Seven, like the number. Your born name is Steve. I'd be curious to know how you came to be known as Seven.
Yeah, sure. It just came up as a nickname in the crypto community. Just Steven drop D. Since addresses in crypto alphanumeric, I figured just having a single number as a nickname was kind of fun. It's pretty simple one.
It's pretty cool.
Makes for very short email addresses. Literally the number 7 at orchid.com, and that's it. So
That's a nice perk as well. So I want to start back in your earlier days. You went to Cambridge, ultimately left with a PhD in speech recognition, an interesting field, obviously, separate from crypto where you are now. I'd be curious to hear about your experience there and maybe what got you into speech recognition. And that seems like it was kind of a little ahead of its time in that field. So I would love to hear the story there.
Yeah, so the big irony there, of course, is that with my accent, none of the speech recognition systems actually understand me, whether they're for British English or American English. So there's a somewhat of an irony there. I end up putting on a fake accent when I want to get understood by Siri or other things. In the early 90s, I started working in speech recognition using what today is called deep learning, so neural networks. And generally did a lot of research in the field of machine learning using a new algorithm that had just come out, which I adapted for doing faster adaptation of speech recognition and working on a deep learning architecture that had been developed at Cambridge and trying to improve the training speeds, which was one of the biggest challenges we were facing back then. But we were working on large vocabulary speech recognition, which is really today what we understand as speech recognition. And each year, the amount of words that we were trying to recognize was going up, the vocabulary was increasing, the kind of environments and noise conditions were getting harder. And a lot of that technology has really sort of algorithms have stayed roughly similar to what they were back then. But the big advantage now in speech recognition, of course, is that our computing capabilities, whether it's on small phones like we're using today or servers, have just increased enormously. So I did some work when I first moved out to the West Coast for a summer in 95 with a company that was doing speech recognition, a little startup. And then when I moved out in 97 full-time, kind of moved away from speech recognition, moved into more generalized machine learning and deep learning. We had a little consulting firm back then working for guys like NASA, and then eventually moved into working with a lot of internet companies like eBay and Yahoo and Craigslist back in the early days, helping them with things like personalization and analytics on their data.
What were you doing with those sorts of companies, like specifically like NASA or Google?
NASA, we had just the most amazing projects we were working on. We had one project where we were modeling space junk. So whenever there's a rocket goes up, they leave bits behind, or if a satellite crashes into something, it blows up. And this stuff just sits around in the atmosphere, and there are all these crazy pieces of space junk sitting around. And modeling these things with kind of deterministic equations can become incredibly complicated. So we were doing techniques based on machine learning approaches to do it in a more probabilistic method, I guess, is the way thinking about it, and enable it to be done at a much faster scale. We also built some technology around wind tunnel modeling. So when you get an aircraft and you want to put it in a wind tunnel to try and figure out what the new aircraft's going to look like when it flies, the cost of doing that is very expensive. And so one of the things we worked on was looking at the profile of the aircraft and the changes that have been made and doing predictions to what it looked like the aircraft was going to fly like in the future, and thus reducing costs for these guys. And lots of other interesting projects. We were We weren't venture funded. We were essentially funded using government research grants and NASA consulting projects. And then we were able to use that to segue into essentially bootstrapping and funding ourselves to develop kind of like internet relevant machine learning tech. Somewhat ironic in that the early work I did in that space, which was quite similar to what became Google AdWords, some startups we were working on back then in that group, was a lot about personalization and tracking of data. And then many years later, I'm working in a space which is kind of against that.
Yeah, so it sounds like you've gone from kind of helping companies like Google with some of the personalization and data tracking to enable that, and now you're on the other side with Orchid, helping people protect their information and you know, keep companies from leveraging the data to you know, whether it's censor, surveil, or just take advantage via ad campaigns or things like that.
I never tried to admit that I have a particular career, because I feel like careers are things you have in like as a in being an entrepreneur. I figure you just, that's your career. You're always trying to find something interesting to do and something you feel passionate about. After the sort of deep learning, machine learning startup, I ended up running security and analytics for a dot-com company, and got really exposed to the kind of field of hacking and just understanding how at risk all of our personal data was. And subsequently, was running engineering for a startup working on decentralized technologies back in the early 2000s. We worked on decentralized search technologies, and then we were acquired by Sun Microsystems. And then I built out with the team that was already there, the open source project that Sun was running for peer-to-peer networking. And this was really kind of decentralized systems before cryptocurrencies.
So you were kind of surrounded with this early, you know, pre-crypto peer-to-peer technology. At some point, you know, we're talking, it sounds like late 1990s and then early 2000s. At some point in the early 2010s, I think like 2012, 2013, you discovered Bitcoin for the first time. Can you tell us the story of how you came across that?
Yeah, so like I said, my career has been bouncing around a few different things. Since 2013, I've been exclusively focused on cryptocurrencies, initially Bitcoin. The story of that one get there was a little convoluted. My own incubator and different startup ideas, truly trying to start my own thing from scratch. And to kind of pay the bills, I ended up consulting and then starting a company in the intellectual property space, fighting patent trolls. This is a company called RPX. So we started that in 2008, and you know, kind of like in August 2008, I think we received our first round of funding from Kleiner Perkins, and then the world had changed, right? And in 2011, we took the company public. 2012, started a fund focused on intellectual property, and then ended up at Fortress Investment Group, running analytics and CTO for that fund. I quickly decided that I'd had enough of being an intellectual property and wanted to kind of use my skills to build things again in the startup world. And in chatting with Pete Brigger from Fortress, he's just inspired me to, you know, perhaps think something I could do at Fortress rather than leaving. So I came back a few weeks later after chatting to some of my friends, especially some of my friends from the cypherpunk and kind of hacking community, and one of them had suggested Bitcoin. And then to cut a long story short, that digital currency fund of Fortress, which was originally Pete Brigger, Mike Novogratz, and then subsequently Dan Moorhead, we spun that out into Pantera, which in late 2013, we had already got a small Bitcoin long-only fund, because at the time, buying Bitcoin was really sketch. It was kind of very hard for people to understand how to do it and which exchanges to use and so on. So we essentially would do that for people and custody it. And then we also started doing investments in companies like Bitstamp and Zappo and Circle and so on in our first venture fund. We then started another venture fund in 2014. And then over the next couple of years, had the privilege of working with many of the really early people in the space, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and then blockchain and smart contracts. And then I left in 2016 to pursue my own ideas. And then in 2017, I got together my co-founders and started Orchid. We can talk about that more also.
Sure. So let's walk through that slowly a little bit. And I appreciate the background. But so 2012, 2013, when you discover Bitcoin and you spin out from Fortress with this venture fund and then the second venture fund, you know, in those days, correct me if I'm wrong, Bitcoin was, you know, double digit, low triple digit prices. And now it's obviously five digits. So that's well ahead of the curve. You know, early days, it launched in 2009, 2010. You guys at that time and for a while were the largest fund holding Bitcoin, I understand, and one of the largest holders of Bitcoin overall, you know, including non-funds, including individuals who were early in the game. What was your guys' role at that time in kind of the growth? Obviously, you're investing in these Bitcoin-related startups as well. Did you guys view yourselves as having some responsibility for the kind of mass adoption of this technology?
Yeah. So in those early days, if you compare it to today, I think that the question that I realize is not so much a question for most people is this Bitcoin thing going to stick around? Is it for real? And now the arguments are more kind of, still around, is this thing worth something? And we can talk about that, of course. What is anything really worth? And then it's a question of, is this thing going to get used and how is it going to get used? And a lot of those questions are starting to get answered more and more. I don't know about essentially like a sense of responsibility. I guess I always feel a sense of ownership and responsibility of anything I'm focused on. And it was just a very wild time. When we started the fund at Fortress and then began spinning it out into Pantera, the Mt. Gox, the Silk Road, for example, first was seized. And that was quite a shock to things. But in a sense, it also was a kind of cleaning up of the space because there was a lot of Bitcoin moving around because of the Silk Road. And then Mt. Gox hack happened in early 2014. I was on the board of Bitstamp at that point, and we quickly became the largest fund, the largest exchange in the world. And then subsequently in a year or so later, we were subject to a hack, and we had to take the entire system offline and bring it back up online. So there was definitely a sense of responsibility of, there were moments where the entire Bitcoin ecosystem could have collapsed. I don't think irrevocably, but there was enough issues over a short period of time that you did have the sense of responsibility of, if we don't get these things right, for example, our work with Bitstamp, this whole thing could just disappear for at least a period of time. And yeah, it was a challenging and definitely an exciting time to be involved in that.
So I don't want to talk about, you know, speculate on price. I think it's somewhat silly with any type of near term view. But you mentioned that, you know, back then people were talking about, will this thing survive? Is this thing legit? And now it's more so a question of what is this going to be worth? I still actually, you know, I became aware of Bitcoin in 2016, started investing around 2017, around the big spike and then subsequent fall, and only have really educated myself and started to really get it within the last year or so. And so my question, maybe just because I'm newer to it, is still, is this thing legit and will this thing survive? And I can't really come up with too many scenarios that point to a no. based on, you know, all the research and diligence I've done and experts who I've heard from. Do you see any situation in which it could, you know, not just drop in value, but really be severely compromised? And if so, what do those situations or scenarios look like?
Yes, a great question. I wish I knew.
good point. I was just going to say, you know, part of it is, I think if there is something that's going to lead to its demise, it seems that no one knows what that would be. It's going to be something that is either unpredicted or predicted by a few very quiet mm-hmm. voices, but none of the people who are really in the space.
Yeah, I think the conversation around Bitcoin has moved in a lot of directions. When we first got into it, our perspective was this is digital gold, and so you hold it. But at the time, people were looking at it as, okay, this is a digital currency. Like how can we use it for the things you use currencies for? Like you pay for things, you buy your Starbucks coffee, you do this, do that, and you move it around really fast. And so there's a lot of focus on how do we make this faster? And subsequently, we've seen development of things like Lightning and off-chain solutions to help with that. But at the same time, we've seen other technologies in the more generalized blockchain space, whether it's with other chains, whether it's with smart contract technologies, that have changed the conversation around from can we move this thing around fast to, well, maybe Bitcoin is just digital gold and everything else has its own purpose that we will see how it works. So you're almost like designing different chains and different architectures for specific purposes. And to that point, we're starting to see, for example, in the gaming communities, we're seeing different blockchains being developed for NFTs, for in-game assets. And you could do that on Bitcoin, but it's people, the attention has moved to other kinds of architectures. And also, I don't think that even back then in the early days, we didn't really feel like there was a case for Bitcoin to necessarily be held on everyone's phone so that it could be used to buy coffee. If you really believe this is digital gold, then why are you spending gold to buy coffee? Because you're assuming this gold is going to go up. So I think it's important to think through what your belief system is around an asset and essentially act accordingly. I think that within the general cryptocurrency space, there are some potential challenges in the future that will depend upon some emerging technologies. I think that the zero knowledge proof space, teams like Starkware in Israel, there's some architectures there that have the potential to build extremely fast, private and scalable currency technologies. And the question is then whether or not people feel there's also a reason to hold that value. But it's also quite hard, I think, to challenge Bitcoin's dominance in terms of people's general knowledge on it. And if you think through this, essentially the branding and marketing campaign that has not really been done by one individual, but by many companies in the space, you ask the average person in the street if they've heard of Bitcoin, and they're like, yeah, I've kind of heard of Bitcoin. But you ask them about Ethereum, and they're like, oh, what is that? Is that something from Lord of the Rings? And yet that, for us, is like, you know, that's the big story at the moment, is what's happening with Ethereum and DeFi and so on. You start getting down the list, and you say Polkadot or Tron or like and so on, and you've lost people immediately. So I think if someone's saying, oh, hey, I've got some savings, and I want to invest in this digital currency thing, they go straight to Bitcoin. And then maybe when they're in Bitcoin, then they get a bit further down the rabbit hole and get into Ethereum. And then maybe you get further and further. And before you know it, they're DeFi yield farming. But that takes a long time for most people to even think about that. And they're certainly not being adopted by 401k plans or by fund of funds and so on. It's really just, let's put some money in Bitcoin. So I think that's, you know, kind of read between the lines as to how I think about this. I don't really have a prediction around where does Bitcoin go? Or what's the eventual price? I think it's digital gold. So that's probably what it will look like over time. But, you know, if Elon finds some gold on an asteroid, then of course all bets are off, right?
So let's leave it at that. I think that's a great way for people to think about it. That's how I personally think about it, at least from one perspective, is Bitcoin is digital gold. And, you know, people can make their deductions on what it's worth in their mind from there. As part of Pantera, leading Pantera, you were one of the first investors in Zcash, if not the first institutional money in Zcash, another popular cryptocurrency, similar to Bitcoin, but focused more on privacy. Can you talk about how you came to be invested in that and why it was interesting to you guys?
Yeah, that was a really fun story. So this is really old school stuff. It's like, you know, OG stories. The funny part about that is I remember being invited to speak at the Special Operations Command, SOCOM, which is United States Armed Forces and three-letter agencies. And it was in, I think I'm allowed to talk about this, but it was in this really random place in Florida, and there was tons of security. And I was invited to speak to kind of explain the issues with tracking cryptocurrencies and somewhat trying to put people's minds at ease a little bit, that this wasn't going to become some crazy thing that lots of dodgy people are going to use, and it was sort of the end of the world. So I gave this long lecture on how Bitcoin works and blockchain and all these kind of things that they would need to understand. And then one of the guys at the end said, is there anything we should be concerned about? And I was like, yeah, you really should take a look at this zero knowledge proof technology that's coming out. And, you know, that could change things. And I think about, I can't remember the exact timing, but roughly a year or so later, we were looking around for who's going to work on this kind of technology, because we were really fascinated by the potential for it. And Naval Ravikant, pinged me and said that he was helping raise money for Zcash, and the lead guy was Zuko, who I'd known of from his previous work. And so I started meeting with Zuko on a fairly regular basis and really talking through his vision for how to build this thing, but also how to build it in a way that would also not just get shut down immediately. And if you think through the challenges of building something like this and doing it in a way that there's a team and you're not anonymous, like the original Satoshi personal team did with Bitcoin, and launching something which has privacy built in, and convincing people, state governments, regulators, and so on, that this is not the end of the world, it is not the terrible thing that you might imagine it would be, but is actually, as Zuko very carefully explains and very eloquently puts out, is that governments should want, for example, to have transactions be private for themselves and between, like, you know, one government sending a government of money. Maybe that needs to be a private transaction. Maybe internally there's private transactions. There's plenty of situations where, and the majority of them are, where private transactions are needed and are already the norm and are not just where we kind of knee-jerk move to, which is that, oh, well, if it's private, you must be have something to hide, and therefore you're doing some bad thing, because anyone who has something to hide is bad. And yeah, so we ended up being the first institutional investor into Zcash. We subsequently did follow-on rounds, and we're very excited when they launched, and Zuko and I stay in touch, yeah, we're very excited to see how those guys are still doing.
You mentioned Naval made the introduction. I'm a big fan of his, and a lot of people are. He has almost a religious type following these days, similar to what you see with a lot of people in the crypto space about the space in general. What were his contributions in the early days? You mentioned kind of that was somewhat of an OG story. Was he behind the scenes coordinating a lot of these early fundraises? I mean, he's, at that time, he wasn't as well known, but he was already a super successful entrepreneur and investor. And his whole, you know, business was helping startups raise money through AngelList. I imagine he took a similar role with some of the early cryptos.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. When we were raising money for Orchid and Naval was an investor, he did remind me that he'd been tweeting about the idea of, at the time he called it a Tor coin, you know, some of the architecture for Orchid is inspired by the onion routing aspects of Tor, and was kind of saying, how come no one's done this before? And I was like, I don't know, but we're doing it. But yeah, in our time at Pantera, we overlapped a little bit. So I know him somewhat well socially, also from the San Francisco community. And yeah, he also started Metastable, which is not so well known, but a very successful crypto fund. They were in Zcash, they were in Monero, they were in Ethereum, Bitcoin very early. And he was definitely a very significant influence on people in terms of thinking and of how to think through the value of these things.
I view Metastable and Polychain, which is one of your investors in Orchid as well, a couple others as some of the leading crypto funds in the space. Would you care to talk about any of the others that you've overlapped with over the years and, you know, what their teams have done uniquely or what their strengths of these different funds might have been?
Well, obviously, because I was, you know, one of the early venture investors in the space, we certainly didn't have the size of funds that are being commanded nowadays. So a lot of our work was very much seed, and we were very scrappy in the way we were doing things, because raising a venture fund between 2013 and 16 was definitely an uphill battle. But we had about a $30 million fund also in the venture fund too. The thing I think that's been interesting comparing it to traditional venture investors, and we have guys like Sequoia, Andreessen, DFJ as traditional venture funds in our first round. The difference I found, and especially also in comparing it to venture investments that I've had in previous startups, is that the challenge that these funds face, I believe, in helping early companies is that the founders, and especially the technical founders, have such a significant advantage in their understanding of what they're doing than is typical in early stage startups. It's almost like the technology curve is moving so fast, and they really are the experts in terms of what they're doing in the founding team. And so the amount of really deep technical expertise that can be brought to bear from the venture fund is limited. The other thing I've noticed is that a lot of the venture funds end up acting as a hybrid of venture and hedge fund. And hedge funds will do often like spread their bets across a number of different possible outcomes. Venture funds in the old school startup world in San Francisco and Silicon Valley have been, we make a bet and we just bet on that thing. If there's a YouTube, we're only in YouTube, we're not in Vimeo, and so on. In the crypto space, it's like, well, maybe we'll invest in this, or we'll invest in the competitor, and we're not quite sure exactly what's going to happen. And I think that's typical of something which is just very rapidly emerging and no one quite sure where it's going to go. But it does tend to somewhat lead to, I guess, kind of like a hands-off approach by a lot of investors. It ends up being just money. And then potentially the brand that goes with that money. Although the brand can be sometimes not always positive when the larger crypto community looks at it and calls you a VC coin or something like that. So one of the reasons we brought in teams like Sequoia and DFJ, or now Threshold, and other groups was the advantage that we believed they would give us and the knowledge they would give us as we actually built a product. So once we had the crypto backend, which we do, then when you're taking a VPN product to consumers, what are the lessons and also what are the partnerships that those partners can give you? Like a Sequoia, could they get you a partnership with WhatsApp or Facebook and so on? Those are the things where we thought there would be a significant advantage that we would bring companies like those in.
So I want to get to what we're talking about now with Orchid, your current venture, where you raised from a number of different VCs as well as crypto funds. Wrapping up your stint with Pantera, 3 or 4 years, you left, I understand, at some point in 2016. Around that same time, you were the victim of a pretty sophisticated phone hack. I read you wrote a blog about it at the time. And I don't know how much you were thinking about it then, but sort of predicted your own entry into the privacy world and creating something to help things like this hopefully not happen to other people, to have their privacy invaded. And basically with Orchid, you wanted to end censorship and surveillance on the internet and return it kind of to its original values about access and privacy. With the belief that kind of everyone should have free and unsurveilled and uncensored access to information worldwide and the ability to share that. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, that transition period from leaving Pantera to having that hack and then starting Orchid?
Yeah, so after I left Pantera, I was perfectly honestly just a little sad about cryptocurrencies and blockchain in general. This was before the token wave and the ICOs. This was a year before that. And I started looking really carefully at security, surveillance, censorship. I was starting to become very concerned about just macro trends I saw in that area and things like how messaging applications were ultimately centralized and if they were subject to government coercion, what would that mean? The general issues around the large scale gathering of data and usage of it by large internet portals. So I just had very much like a concern. I started thinking about building almost like a think tank, a bit like OpenAI, if you're familiar with that, Elon Musk's and others, Sam Altman's work on building open source AI technologies. And I was like, well, maybe we could do the same thing for security. Maybe we could press the reset button and try and build operating systems and application platforms where security and privacy are built in by default, not as a afterthought. And if you look back in time, the development of HTTP was first, and then as an afterthought, we put in SSL and encrypted communications. But I was really working quite seriously on that, and also consulting still in the blockchain space. And then I think it was in October 2016, I got a strange message on my phone and then a phone call from somebody asking me a question that they said they were writing a blog. And I wrote about this in my Medium article. And the question seemed innocuous, but I realized that it was a security, like one of those stupid private questions that you're supposed to put into something. And then I got a call from Verizon asking me if I wanted to port my phone number. And I was like, no, someone's trying to hack me. You need to lock everything up right now. And, you know, no offense to Verizon, because this has actually been a across all of these different carriers. They've all had issues. So I put in controls on Verizon and so on, woke up the next morning and everything had been ported. And so I sat there, I was like, oh, that's okay, because I have 2FA and I have all these things. And then I realized that I left one thing open when I was doing some administration on one of my websites, and there was essentially a hole in my architecture. So they were in my email accounts, and then they were trying to 2FA into crypto accounts and kind of all the things that anyone who's been studied this kind of attack. Once you have control of a phone number, there's a lot of things you can do to people. And just for the excited hackers out there, my architecture is significantly improved and different now. I'm not going to put that as a challenge, but I definitely take care of things in a different way now. But it really woke me up. It really woke me up to the idea that, not specifically that, hey, I need to start an anti-phone porting company, although I looked quite carefully into that idea and some other people have been working on that, but really put me down a rabbit hole of Sometimes as a venture investor, you can spend a lot of time thinking about lots of different things that could be done. And until somebody comes along with something, you don't have the courage or convictions. But as an entrepreneur, you need to just be motivated, and perhaps motivated by an extrinsic source. And that really was it for me. The search through ideas around privacy as it related to phone networks led me into thinking about VPN technology and how that worked and the market for that, which I hadn't studied significantly up until that point, and really noticed that it was a very fragmented space, and there was a lot of issues with who do you trust? Can you trust VPNs? I talked to friends of mine running engineering at different VPN companies who explained that the business model for many VPN companies was to actually sell your data in an aggregated format, which any aggregated format can be reduced down to single information if you're smart enough. And then chatting actually to the inspiration for building the sort of incentivized tokenized network was thinking this through from a perspective of, if you're going to do VPNs, then why don't you do onion routing and layered networks also? And then instead of it being volunteer based, like the traditional onion routing networks, maybe you incentivize it. And conversations with Olaf from Polychain were very instrumental in inspiring that idea. And then I was lucky enough to meet some incredible co-founders, Jay Freeman, who'd built out Cydia and the jailbreaking framework for the iPhone and built the first app store for the iPhone for jailbroken iPhones. Gustav Simonsson, who'd been early Ethereum core security team, and Brian Fox, who was first employed the Free Software Foundation and wrote Bash, which is on all of our devices now. So that was our initial founding setup. And then we were lucky enough to get some amazing support from some great partners in Silicon Valley and beyond. And yeah, it's been a journey ever since. I was talking to someone the other day and they said, wow, you guys are like really OG because, you know, you started this thing in 2017. And I was like, yeah, I've been doing this since 2013. So I guess I'm really double OG. But it is quite different when you see things like SushiSwap, which gets started in a few days and then, you know, like has half the liquidity of Uniswap in a month. Building networking technology, which is what we're doing, in addition to building smart contracts and running all the game theory on how those systems should work, is quite challenging. Put it that way. It's a hard labor of love to get those kind of things right. And our layer two smart contract scaling technology, our layer two payments technology, runs at data networking speeds, which is quite significantly faster than what most people think of for payment networks, for example. We actually send packets in, we send payments with every single packet that comes from the phone and is received by node providers. So there's been a lot of very interesting innovations that we've brought in. Yeah, this stuff takes time. And to do it right, I think it takes time.
So you talked a bit about the formation of the early team and, you know, some of your motivations for creating what you've set out to build with Orchid. Can you just kind of explicitly and fundamentally explain what Orchid is and why it's important?
Yeah, sure. So we've been trying to build the VPN that you expect, and sort of a funny tagline, but the challenge with existing VPN architectures is you have to trust a VPN node. You have to trust that whoever your VPN provider is doing what they're telling you they're doing. They're actually making your data private. That's what a VPN does.
And sorry to interrupt, but just maybe define a VPN for those who aren't familiar.
Yeah, of course. So when you use your phone or your computer connected to the networks that you're used to, whether in the US is something like a Verizon or an Xfinity or even like a public access network, like in a Starbucks or at a conference, well, if we ever have conferences again, but at a conference, you're using a public Wi-Fi. All the traffic that's coming from your device is going through a provider, like a service provider, an internet service provider. And that internet service provider can start figuring out a lot of different things based on your IP address, the address of your device that you're using. And there are, for example, data sharing agreements between ISPs and different government agencies, different data collection groups that are not government but corporations. And another issue you have is that in many parts of the world, and even in, for example, in US high schools, there are blocking of different kinds of content that you're allowed to see. And one of the most famous examples for this is China. The Great Firewall blocks traffic to a large percentage of internet addresses in the world for censorship reasons, what the government wants you to read and what it doesn't want you to read. Tiananmen Square, for example, that is not available anywhere in China, information about that, or if it is, it talks about it as being a peaceful student protest. And with a VPN, you can jump out of that firewalled area and essentially cross the firewall and access content that you otherwise wouldn't be able to. So there are both anti-surveillance issues and anti-censorship issues that you can bring in, and just a general concept of privacy. Privacy is a very layered term, but that's what you think of as a virtual private network. What we're doing with ORCID is, first of all, our application is available on iOS and Android and OS X and with some other platforms that the community is working on. It allows you to pay for your connection using cryptocurrency. So now you no longer have to give somebody a credit card and give all your information, your address and so on. You just go get some OXT, our cryptocurrency, and pay for a connection. And so first of all, then the payment part of it is now decentralized, which is, we think, is a significant advantage. The second thing that allows us to do is that we're able to have a large number of nodes in the network, in the ORCID network, not just a single VPN company, but potentially many people running those nodes. In our initial network, which is running today, we have 7 different entities. None of them are ORCID. We don't run any infrastructure at all. And they are providing bandwidth and the routing in the network, similar to a standard VPN. And these guys are actually professionally run VPN companies. And then you say, okay, well, how do you know that you can trust them? Well, maybe you can't. Maybe you can't trust ORCID, who's the company that's currently managing the list of the nodes that you can send traffic to. Maybe we're doing a bad job of that. Well, okay, now you can set up your own list if you like. You can decide that, you know, I'm gonna go run some ORCID nodes and I think I can do this better. Or I've got a bunch of friends running VPN companies in South Korea and we want to build a South Korean version. All our code's open source. The network is fully decentralized. There are just many different advantages to how we've architected the system to really build not just a consumer-focused VPN client, which we have, but also a framework for other people to build those kind of clients and other people to run the VPN and other kinds of applications on the ORCID network. In a more broader sense, where we're working on with the community, and this is really being led very much because it's an open source community, is the idea of if VPN services are one kind of service that you can run in a decentralized way, just like we've gone from finance to decentralized finance, what if we could have a more general framework for decentralized services? And you could imagine decentralized compute services. We are seeing now with Filecoin emerging that our decentralized storage systems being built. So in a more general sense, we're thinking and working on technologies that allow us to move beyond just simple bandwidth services to other kinds of idea, all with the basis of an underlying privacy by default.
That's great. So you talk about the importance of people being able to access internet freely, unsurveilled, uncensored. One example that I think will resonate with a lot of people, you mentioned, you know, as simple as high schoolers being able to go on Instagram where their school might not permit them to do that on their server. A more serious example is with COVID. In the early days, there was a doctor in Wuhan who, you know, raised a red flag about, he thought it was like a SARS type outbreak. And was censored, my understanding is, through one of the Chinese companies' chat platforms, from being able to kind of distribute that message across China and around the world. And do you have any thoughts basically on, you know, a situation like that? To me is like a great use case for describing why it's so important that people should be able to share information, even if it's wrong. Which, you know, you could argue if you try to take the positive side of things that China just didn't want to scare people or whatever it might've been. But, and I'm not saying that was the reason for the censorship, yeah. But even if it was innocent, people deserve to be able to get their message out because it could be, you know, in this case, save hundreds of thousands of lives.
Yeah, I agreed. And the whole, what is fake news and what is dangerous is a separate rabbit hole we can talk about sometime. But that particular case, and rather sadly, that doctor died of COVID like a month or so after that whole situation started. He was censored on a WeChat group. He was disciplined and questioned by police. And yeah, that was actually in early December of last year. So if that information had been more widely available, even if it was necessary, even if like there was a different universe where that was a scare thing and didn't really exist, then that had, we had the kind of right to know that this was a global issue eventually that has really changed life globally, probably semi-permanently and mostly permanently for a lot of things. And I think that particular issue and subsequent issues that have come around because of COVID, for example, track and trace and digital contactless tracing and the sort of overreach now of governments into people's lives. There was a case of a guy in South Korea who they were tracking people based on geolocations of their phones, and he got called out because he was in some dodgy part of Seoul and publicly shamed for visiting in like a karaoke bar or something. And it turned out to be actually an error in the geolocation data, but this guy's life was ruined for a short period of time. Is this kind of, you often see this in these crises moments, whether it's a national security crisis or pandemics as we're seeing now, where there's a strong overreach of government into people's lives from a perspective of surveillance and a loss of privacy. That my concern is that it's very hard to unwind that over time. Examples of the Patriot Act, which just recently got bilateral support again, and another revision has been approved. And we are 19 years after 9/11, and yet this act, which has very wide-ranging and strong sort of intrusive reach into people's lives, is still there and still getting approved. What about the laws that might get put in place for COVID and the technologies that get put in Google or Android phones that allow people to understand even more about your behavior than they already do, which is enormous. So I think that's my concern as to what does life look like. I'm not going to say in a post-COVID world, but in 5 years' time, what do things look like beyond this?
Right, that's an interesting perspective. And speaking of COVID, obviously it's driven a lot of people, you know, the majority of the states at least, to companies to be working remotely. Last question, then I want to ask you about a new development with Orchid. But you guys were, Orchid, I mean, was remote prior to the pandemic, I understand. Would love to hear what went into that decision to be remote, if it was just a convenience thing or more strategic than that, and what advantages might have come from being in that position when the whole world is kind of forced unpredictably to follow suit.
Yeah, it's... So we've been essentially distributed team since the beginning of the company. We have, and we're about to leave an office in San Francisco. And certainly given my background of building companies, you know, with offices and in San Francisco, my thought was, well, we'll have this distributed team, but we'll also have a core team of developers in San Francisco physically, or like at least they'll be there. We'll like go to the office and we'll have these things going on. In the end, over the period of 3 years that we built in the company, that happened a little bit. We definitely brought in talent from the Bay Area, but because the larger team was all working in a distributed fashion, whereas we would have sort of like war room sessions or sessions where everybody was in one place for like when we launched the company and so on, a lot of us were like really dug in and we had people coming and visiting in the office. When the lockdown started here, we very quickly adapted to just being fully remote and we had to adjust in some small way the kind of practices we had for working and it took a minute to get there, but I think we had a bit of a head start on many people who were using Zoom for the first time or trying to understand how to use Notion or just, you know, how do I run time zones? How do I run my life? And I think the mistake a lot of people have made through this period is, like in San Francisco, we're still in basically some form of lockdown. Things are not really open, and especially with the incredibly bad fires we've had recently, the streets are empty of traffic, of people. And I think the mistake people are still making is feeling like this is temporary and we're going to go back to normal soon, like when there's a vaccine or something else happens. I think there's been a fundamental change in society, in work, in education, in having relationships. I think it's shifted. And it's not just been because of COVID. I think it's been happening for many, many years. But this pandemic, lockdowns in different places, have accelerated history to the point where our future is going to look very different. It doesn't mean I don't think we'll ever have a conference again where we all meet in person, but I do think there'll be less. I do think there'll be more sparsely attended. I think there maybe will be, in the case of conferences, I think there'll be almost like a hybrid online in real life combination. I think things like virtual reality will become accelerated in adoption and usage. I have a lot of predictions of where I think things are going, but assuming things are temporary, I think is a very big mistake right now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I wrote a piece towards the beginning of this called Seeing the Future in the Dark about how basically we turn the lights off on the whole world and people are going to adapt to that. And, you know, whenever the lights go back on, if, you know, say there's a vaccine, and obviously it's not going to be night and day like a lot of people think. But when things do start to return to, you know, more comfortability with meeting in person and things like that, there's all the legacy of people having adapted to life in the times of COVID, you know, ordering their groceries online, traveling less, going to the office less. And you can't just take those things back. People can't kind of unsee the changes that they've seen in their lives and the changes that they've made. So I totally agree with you that, you know, if there is a return to normal, if you want to call it that, it's going to be a very new normal and a very different way than, you know, 2019 was. Last question. I understand by the time I release this, by the time this conversation's out in public, Orchid's going to have made an announcement. Would love to hear what that is. I don't know it myself. So would love to have you talk about that briefly.
Yeah, so we're doing an extension to an existing collaboration with Chainlink. Chainlink's a network of decentralized oracles. And what this new capability in is makes it easier for the Orchid application and for users of the network to determine the price of bandwidth on any particular VPN. So we're going to be making, and I think by this point it will be live, the second oracle that we've created in collaboration with Chainlink and the overall communities in both groups, aggregates information from the providers in the Orchid network and gives users a better estimate of the cost of bandwidth. It also acts as a kind of secret shopper, which samples bandwidth pricing from different providers in the Orchid network and builds this sort of generalized pricing information for the users. So it'll give people an easier tool and the application's an easier way to estimate the price of services on the network.
So that sounds like it'll help people kind of optimize the price at which they're buying and help drive competition on the VPN side. Is that somewhat accurate?
Yeah, and I think that over time, you can imagine these kind of oracles to also start to give information, not just around price, but also, you know, uptime, availability, those kind of things that you need. And as I was talking about before, we're really doing a lot of these things in this work, in really being driven a lot by ideas with the community and development there, to build a path to the idea of decentralized services and what does that future look like. And that's really a lot of our thinking process there.
That's great. Well, Seven, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your perspective. It's a fascinating story, and really interested to see what comes of Orchid. I think it's a really exciting project. Want to give you the last word just to share, you know, where people should go to learn more about Orchid, download it, learn more and read stuff from you. Anything else you want to leave people with?
Sure. Okay. Well, all the information is found on our website. It's orchid.com. That's ORCHID.com, just like the flower. Our Twitter is Orchid Protocol. My Twitter is D7Trol, which is DESEVENTRAL. It's kind of like decentral, but with a seven in it. And yeah, we'd be happy to hear from you and love to learn more about people's ideas for where this can go and help you improve your privacy online. Thank you so much, Jake.